This is Surviving the Music Industry.
That sounds sick.
I didn't think about how that sounded.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another beautiful episode of Surviving the Music Industry, SMI, as I like to call it. It's not SMI, it's not STMI, it's not a venereal disease, but it's SMI. I'm Brandon Harrington. I'm your tour guide through my life that is just a fecal-filled matter of a waterfall that hits a propelled fan every once in a while. And then I get to have pretty rad conversations. Thomas Chorba is on the docket today. We had a great conversation not that long ago, a little bit just before you got hitched. Congrats, though, Thomas Chorba, for locking in a partner in crime, a PIC. Those aren't easy to find. Marriage. I've been thinking a lot about that, especially since this conversation. Oh, Thomas just tied the knot. And some of the best piece of advice was from Vicky on my honeymoon. So we were already hitched. We took a cruise because we're just lazy Americans that way. And it was before, you know, the sinking of the ships, after the Titanic, but before, you know, Carnival just kind of was a beached whale for a little bit. Vicky and I were hanging out in the smoker section. I had a pipe. I bring a pipe on vacations, kind of wherever I kind of go. Vicky's an avid smoker. And we got talking as smokers do. And I kind of wish it was like a normal habit because I love hanging around smokers because that's what you do. You hang around, you smoke, and you just talk. You talk about life. It's kind of a beautiful thing. You know, non-smokers, what do they really have? They got nothing. You know you're going to die early from lung cancer, but that's why you got to get all the conversations, all the hearts and feelings out all in one time. But either way, got to know Vicky. At that time, she was probably, I don't know, 40 plus and raspy voice, smoker, and some of the best advice she said, when you get in an argument, just get butt naked. Just get clean naked, hash it out. I've never followed that advice, but there's something pretty awesome about that because it'd be kind of hard to have a fight when both people are naked. I don't know how many times she got naked. She was also on her honeymoon, but it was like her third honeymoon. So I don't know if that was just a thought that ever crossed her mind for herself to get naked and get into a fight, but I don't know. But hope everybody's really doing out there all over the world in this inclusive environment we try to set up. Get a hold of us at Unofficial Brandon. I got TikTok and Instagram that way, but all other stuff at SMI Podcast. And you can always go to smipodcast.com. But really hope you guys are doing well. I'm not doing too great today. It's a little cloudy or rainy, and it's hard for me to be creative when I'm kind of in a down slump. And so you would think that'd be like pretty awesome to get into the creative spirit in the down. But not for me. It's kind of tough to be motivated. I kind of don't know what that is. I'm blaming the weather, blaming the lack of sleep. I tried installing a cabinet like last night, I think, and it just fell to the ground. So, I don't know. When just so many things are just kind of happening, I feel like in my life, all at kind of one time, it's just not, you know, conducive or just like the structure of my life to what I want it to be. It feels a little depressing. It's almost as if like you're pushing a boulder uphill constantly. And it's, you know, one step forward, two steps back, and one boulder going all the way down the hill. And then you got to go get it. That's kind of what I feel like right now. I don't know what that is in the headspace, but that's just kind of where I'm at right now. Keep in touch with me at Unofficial Brandon, at SMI Podcast. You guys ever feel this way? That's another thing about this thing. I like to let you know that you're not alone in your headspace. That's also a beautiful thing, right? But I hope everybody, again, I just keep saying, is doing well because it is just kind of a fecal free-for-all and a propelled fan as of right now. Everywhere in the world, I really feel like. So I think if there's any time to be connected in a disconnected world right now, let's get connected. And you never know where it goes. I mean, I met an artist named Stephen Babcock just over the Grams. And Tyler Dial is another guy over the Grams. Had them on the show. I'm not going to say it's going to work out every single time. They just happen to do pretty cool music and they got good stuff kind of going on in their life. But we've hung out and we've done the thing. I know for sure, this was the first time I ever hung out with Thomas Chorba. And I didn't know Thomas. I was introduced to his music from his publicist. And it takes a long time for me to gravitate toward like a new artist, especially introduced to a publicist, because we all know some of the raddest music that you find are the ones that you discover yourself. Well, in this case, I was introduced to Thomas, and it's his second record. It's his self-titled, and to me, it's a little bit of a debut. It's not in the grand scheme of things his catalog is debut, but I think it's a pretty rad record, and I got into it. It was produced by Bo Bedford, the Texas gentleman. Man, I was blown away and I don't want to sound like a dad when I say this, but the dude is just so young, and just the thoughts and the philosophies and everything that kind of embody who Thomas is and his sounds were just so mature for what it is. And I was blown away. I was blown away the entire time. And kind of his thought processes, like in the songs and the music, it all kind of runs parallel with me on the highway. And so I said, why not? Let's do this. I want to get to know this guy. We get to know the guy in this episode. So if you guys are brand new to Thomas Jordan, maybe you're a fan of Thomas, you get to learn a bunch of new stuff that you probably never learned before. Especially we go through the family stuff. We go through his school stuff. We go through the whole thing. And then eventually, you guys know the drill, we get to the present time, how the past influenced the new record and everything. I mean, we talk about Woody Guthrie, talk about Johnny Cash, talk about songwriting. We go through it all. But that self-titled debut record comes out September 25th on all streaming platforms. Go give him a follow at Thomas Chorvin Music on those socials. Be sure to go to his website, too. That's where you can stay up to date. I mean, if there's any dream a kid could have at a Make-A-Wish Foundation of Rona 2020, for Thomas, it would be to take this record out on the road and tour it. This was going to be the year for him. Can't do it. So all I have to say is go show him some love. Go to the website. Go to thomaschorba.com. It's C-S-O-R-B-A. Go visit him. Go buy the record. Treat yourself. Treat yourself and go even to his socials and even say, thanks for the rad conversation. Where can I get this record? He'll be happy to tell you. There's links in the bios. Everywhere you can go, we'll have links at smipodcast.com. But I really love getting to know Thomas. So here we go.
I think what's crazy is that, I mean, our initial wedding date was May 9th. And with all this COVID stuff, we pushed it back and pushed it back. And we planned probably 5 weddings at this point. And so I guess the crazy part about it is that it's actually happening. So it's going to feel, I mean, obviously it's going to be a great day and super exciting. Cool. But I'm much more excited to be married than I am to, you know, have my wedding.
Bro, 100%. I mean, I had PTSD of just the idea of doing 5 weddings. You know, I mean, one is bad enough. I mean, you've already know that. And I'm married. I'm still working on my first marriage. So it's like that is the worst of it. Like this moment or the moment before, because our first option was elope. Like, fuck everybody else.
Right.
Let's just go do it. And we got whittled down into like making a thing out of it.
Yeah. I mean, the only way you can have a wedding right now, I think, responsibly, I mean, we're doing, you know, less than 50 people, all outdoors, you know, everybody's kind of like self-isolating before. And, you know, it's at first we kind of expected a big, huge party that some of our friends have had. You know, these weddings down here in Texas get kind of out of hand, just with numbers.
Yeah, it gets rough and rowdy. Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is that I should have got married in Rona 2020. Like, nobody there. That would have been, man, like the dream.
Yeah. There are some perks. There are a couple, like, sympathy gifts I think we've gotten. But I don't know. When my lady and I first got engaged, I was hoping for a 3-month engagement. And I think it'll have been 11 months by the time we get married, just with all the added planning. So I'm ready for the other side of it, that's for sure. But you see the same people. You have your little group of people that you see, you know, I've got some family here in Dallas that I've gotten to see, you know, and do the, you know, outdoor, you know, front porch drinks and those kind of things. And luckily those people that we're close with geographically and that are in that kind of circle, just, you know, aren't annoying in that way.
Right,
we have really great friends. So
awesome. Okay.
I'm grateful, and Alex is grateful too. We talk about this all the time. Just our close friends and the people that are surrounding us, even when it's whittled down to this, you know, smaller circle of people that we're constantly coming in contact with, we've got great people around us. And that's a huge, huge gift, especially in a time like this, because I know that there are a lot of people who aren't in that position. Yeah, you know?
It's a different headspace for a lot of people.
And I don't know if you felt this too, you know, because, or if you've heard this from other musicians or songwriters, but at the beginning of all this, there was a lot of pressure that I felt to, you know, write a bunch of great songs
and write
the great American novel.
Right.
And like,
yeah,
do all these things. It'd be hyper productive. You know, right when the stay at home orders kind of came in here in Dallas, I was on the phone with my buddy who's a songwriter down in Austin, and I was kind of living out of that like productive, almost like fearful kind of mindset, like I have to do blah blah blah. And I asked him, you know, hey man, like, you know, are you writing a bunch? How's this week been? Whatever. And he's like, oh no, like I can't, you know, it's too soon to write.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's somebody who's been doing this for years and I really look up to. And it kind of gave me permission, I think, to settle back and just kind of rest, you know?
Mm.
It's kind of like been a forced like pause button, I feel like, on a lot of people. And once I accepted that, I realized, like, you know, okay, there is something therapeutic about doing yard work or about like organizing my garage. That's really good for me. And I think this, like, perhaps it's an American thing or like a, you know, a young 23-year-old, you know, coming of age kind of thing. But there's this emphasis on productivity that I feel like I'm learning to get over a little bit, you know?
Right. Yeah. Just to let yourself be. That's a hard lesson.
Right.
I think it's a, personally, I think it's an American thing because, I mean, like, you're almost kind of groomed and the thing of, like, well, be active. If you're not active, I mean, idle hands are the devil's best friend, you know? So
yeah.
It's like, really, what are you doing with this time that you have? But I felt that pressure, too, like, especially when it first started. And I even started getting excited for, like, other people, too. You know, like, it's the thing of, like, and I still have this ideal what will happen out of this whole situation, and I feel like we're kind of seeing it. It's just usually when there's just global shitty things happening, and like that's sometimes like some of the best art, that's some of the best music. So
there's
a piece of me that's really excited about what's going to happen after the fact, but I'm not talking like a shitty Michael Bay movie, you know, like
right.
But like just the things that will just happen, like especially musically. And but then also there is a piece of what you just said that definitely resonates in me. It's like to give you that permission of you don't have to have that pressure. You don't have to be the next Tom Waits or something, you know. You don't have to sit there and like just stew on a song in your miserable life. But that's tough.
Yeah.
I deal with that. I deal with that constantly.
It's hard. It's hard too. And Tom Waits is a good example. You know, I grew up, Towns Van Zandt was like my guy when I was a kid. And it's characters like that are heroes in so many ways, but also you have to step back and think, okay, what's the healthiest way for me to, you know, as I'm about to get married, it's like, what kind of husband do I need to be, you know, and eventually what kind of father can I be? And the idea of struggling for your art kind of shifts a little bit in that way,
Oh, 100%. Oh, dude, wait till you have a kid. Shit changes. But, but like, let me, I guess, like, sympathize with you and even help you out that, you know, kids are like Mowgli from the Jungle Book. Like, they just survive.
Yeah.
Like, shit just happens and they just live. They just carry on.
That's cool.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, even if you drop a kid, they bounce, you know? So it's like, I know from experience.
Sounds like you're coming from experience.
There.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that's another great thing, too. Like, I feel like we have a lot of the same heroes. Like, I often even wonder, like, what would Woody Guthrie think, like, in a time like this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, on the political realm. And mind you, I'm not a political guy. I'll have these political conversations. But at the same time, like, what would Woody Guthrie be doing right now?
It's interesting. I was listening to, I forget what it was. Somebody sent me this interview. And they're talking about, and I think this is a related topic, and maybe you can help me bridge the gap here, but that kind of sparked this in my mind. This conversation about whether the teenager, you know, in the 50s and 60s, whether the teenager invented rock and roll, or the rock, or that rock and roll invented the idea of the teenager.
Yeah, right.
Which
yeah.
I think is really interesting. And you look at, obviously, like, you have so many factors that are going into that conversation specifically, like access to automobiles and the highway system, and, you know, kids being able to go out and experience the world and have their own kind of identity, these kind of things. And I think when you think about civil rights era music, or any kind of political music, you know, in the 60s or in the 70s, so on and so forth, I think it just doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, like my buddy Bo, who produced the record, is just like one of these minds and so well educated on the history of music. And I remember asking, like, Bo, what's the deal with the fact that all of my favorite records were either released in 1969 or 1972? Like, what is it about those 2 years? And he said, dude, it was the awesome instruments that were being built in the last couple of years of the 1950s and early 1960s.
Yeah, yeah. There was a lot of awesome new tech and shit. But dude, that was dark times too. Dark times in America.
Right. And so I think, like, you have this conglomerate of things. And so, but at any given moment in history, you know, like, you can't just think about the coronavirus right now in America. You have to think about, and you can't just think about, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement. You have to think about these things in relationship with each other. Because I'm learning, especially now, that these blanket statements of, even if it's Democrats think this way, or Republicans think this way, or do this, or want this, these blanket statements are no good, because these are people, and people are complex, you know?
Yeah, right. It's not a black or white situation. It's not like on a piece of paper and it's laid out in front of you. Like, there's so many layers beyond that sheet of paper. Yeah.
Exactly. There's just so much, there's so many factors going on right now. And, you know, to tie it back to that, I think it's okay to step back and breathe a second and look at it with kind of a perspective of gratitude, if you can. And you kind of look at this mess and think, okay, how can we treat each other better? You know?
Yeah.
You know, creatively, I've been able to, you know, express myself in other places. You know, I'm doing some woodworking these days, and doing, like, you know, keeping my hands busy. And I think these kind of things that we do in our kind of microcosms, I don't know why I'm bringing this up.
No, it's leading somewhere, I feel like. So do you wrestle with, like, anxiety, depression, anything like that?
Not really. No? I mean, okay. There are times that I can get anxious.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I have friends that have struggled with anxiety, you know, like, to the T. And for me to, like, claim that, I think, would dilute what some of my friends have done.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I agree,
you know,
with that.
I've lived a pretty, pretty charmed life, you know, growing up. I had two awesome parents and awesome siblings, like a really great together family.
In Dallas?
And I grew up in Houston.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Grew up in Houston, you know, went to college and graduated and moved up here to be with my girl. You know, like, there haven't been, I've watched people walk through some hardship, but I've struggled with that a little bit. It's like, what do I have to write about if I haven't lived much, you know?
Especially if your heroes are, you know, the Tom Waits or it's the Woody Guthrie.
Right.
It's kind of like, holy shit. Obviously, they went through a different time and they are who they are. Uh-huh. But then it's just that pressure. I mean, if you start comparing yourself like the Woody Guthrie, it's like, oh, shit. I mean, he changed the entire generation. Or you can go to the extreme. I think Woody Guthrie is, you know, not the most extreme, but like a Bob Dylan or something. Like if you put that pressure on your head, bro, that's hard to live up to.
Yeah, it really is. And it's easy to put that pressure on your head, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a quick lie to believe that you have to, you know, your output has to match one of the greatest figures in American history. Certainly American music history. You know, I think that this season, if there's anything that I'm learning, it's one, that I'm not in control, obviously, with having to move my wedding so many times, but two, that, you know, to stay in my headspace, you know, and do work that I believe in and that excites me, and continue to put it out in the world, you know, whether or not somebody's buying a ticket to my show or whether or not I can play a show, you know, write really, really great songs that I'm proud of and that excite me, you know?
Yeah, I understand that. And that's, and at the end of the day, that's all you can do or really want to do. I mean, it's better than, you know, anything else that we talked about in the opposite direction. But yeah, I mean, you're a pretty young dude, right? I mean, like you're 23. I think you already said that.
Yeah.
Are you done with college? You said you did the college thing.
Yeah. I spent 4 years in college, which were great. I mean, I've been putting out records or like putting out music and playing shows since I was 16.
I know. That's what's insane. Like you did the college route, but you're still doing, you know, the thing. You're doing it.
Right. So, and it was a version of the thing, you know, like I did a lot of Texas. I've done so many Texas shows just because that's what I could do on the weekends. You know, I remember driving in from Austin, you know, down to Houston on a Thursday morning because I had a Wednesday night slot at some bar. And I remember specifically my economics teacher looking at me in the eye at like 8:15 in the morning and saying, "Hey, everybody in this room looks tired. You look a different kind of tired." Like, you know, it's like, yeah, I just drove 2 hours. And it was weird and good. And I'm so glad, you know, like I didn't have a ton of friends in high school. I had a couple really good buddies. And I didn't have a ton of friends in college either. But what I did have was experiences, you know, and I was starting to brush shoulders with some really, really phenomenal writers, really phenomenal performers, and getting to see shows too at that young of an age from that perspective was cool. I mean, that stuff is invaluable. So I haven't done the touring thing to like a full extent, like a lot of people have. You know, it's just interesting. This record was supposed to be that for me, you know, I'm out of school and I can actually go, you know, sit in my car and play shows around the country instead of just weekend shows or, you know, take a week off school, whatever. So it's kind of weird. This was supposed to feel kind of like a debut record for me, but I think I'll have that feeling again next time I put something out and get to tour it, you know.
Especially in this situation. I mean, it's a self-titled record. I feel like if you're going to name like your record after your name and then like you're expecting big things because this is like your coming out moment, you know, this is it. You're showing it to the world and you can only like, depending on like whatever budget you got, man, like 40% of the world.
Yeah. It's weird. Like it's definitely the record that has felt the most me, you know? Mm-hmm. But I'm like, okay, I set out to do a thing, and I feel like I did it, you know?
Yeah. But dude, at the end of the day, that man, that's more than what most people can say. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I know people that hate their record.
Yeah. There's a reason why some of those early EPs of mine are nowhere to be found on the internet. But, yeah, it's, you know, I'm grateful for the guys I got to work with. And, you know, I was talking to a friend about this the other day, about just making stuff that excites you, you know. And when I was 16 years old and starting to make records, what excited me was like looking at a pop filter on a microphone stand and being like, whoa, like, I'm going to sing through this thing into the microphone and it's going to go through a cable and be like recorded. Whoa.
Yeah, there's like a, you know, like a wonderment. There's a magic to that, right?
Right. Yeah. That was enough to excite me then. And, you know, this time around, a few, you know, stops in the studio later, what I expect of myself and what I really want to do and what's really fun for me is feeling like I wrote a song that has existed for a while, you know? And when you feel like you do it, man, that's exciting. I don't know what that's going to be like in the future. You know, maybe that means, you know, I make a pop synth record one day, who knows?
That would be pretty legit with your quality and tone of your voice. I would be interested. I'd be into it.
Yeah.
But man, being in Texas, I mean, I know this, like, It's a rad scene, and like the trouble of it is just so vast. It's just so big. I mean, like, you're in Houston, and then you're like, you're driving to Austin where it's legit, and you're seeing shows at like Cactus Cafe, or you're hanging out with your buds there, and you got to go back to Houston, and there's something in Dallas, there's something there, but it just takes forever, like, to me, like in Texas, like, to get anything going.
Yeah, I don't. Maybe I just, like, it's the first thing I did. So it's more that, like, I go out to Nashville or, you know, like, some of these southeastern cities. And I'm like, what? That place is, like, 45 minutes away? How is that a different city?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Whereas, like, it would take me 45 minutes to drive across Houston on a good day.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. I'm kind of conditioned to it, even though I haven't spent a lot of time on the road. Just being in Texas has kind of given me that, like, the understanding of the vastness of this country, even though I haven't quite seen it, you know?
But the thing I really want to say about Texas is, like, it's a world of worlds. And, you know, you can go out to Lubbock, and that's basically like the Southwest, you know? And you can go to, like, to Texarkana, and that's like redneck country. You know?
Sure.
And then, like, and just go south. You're in border towns. Like, it's kind of it's a beautiful melting pot of a place to discover. Like, if Texas is all you know, and, like, that's your sense of America, that's probably okay. Enough. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I've got some friends that tour Texas specifically, and just, you know, you can make a solid living being a Texas-based and Texas confined kind of artist, and so that's the jam, that's some people's jam, and that's fine. I'm excited to see the world, though, you know. I've got family out in Nashville, and so anytime I go up there, it's, you know, that's a taste of kind of, like, from what I understand, like, you've got kind of anchors along your tour schedule, and like, oh, I get to see so and so in this city, or I get a nice warm meal at my sister's house, whatever it is. And so I'm excited for those kind of things, and to look at these new cities, and you know, whatever that may be, it'll be a really exciting and fun thing. But, you know, for now, you know, I get to write and I get to create the stuff that's hopefully going to bring me to those places.
It'll happen. We kind of talked about a little bit of, I mean, your identity. Like, is your identity kind of wrapped up in Texas a little bit? Because there's an idealism there, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Because you want to see the world. There's a cool internal struggle, I feel like, in you, like, so far. Like, you want to see the world, you want to get out there, but there is a strong, like, identity, like, with Texas.
Yeah.
That I feel like every Texan has.
There's definitely, like, a pull here, you know, and a lot of that is family. A lot of that is, like, familiarity, you know?
Yeah, right.
But I could also see, you know, living in Tennessee one day or, and, you know, I've got a buddy who lives in Birmingham and absolutely loves it. One of my best friends. And so I know, you know, I've got kind of people all over the country kind of telling me how great their town is, which is maybe unique. But yeah, I mean, I went to, you know, when I was choosing where to go to college, I thought about going out to Tennessee, UT Knoxville is a place I thought about going. I thought about going to Auburn, which those were great schools and, you know, could have been really fun. But that would have been a wildly different experience than me staying in Texas. And I'm glad I did because, you know, it kept me, there's a certain sense of like being grounded that I felt at least in being just, you know, 3.5 hours from home. And on a bad week, I can drive home and see my parents for a weekend, you know, and kind of recharge.
Where'd you end up going to school? But where though?
I went to Baylor.
Oh yeah. Okay. So it's still home. It's a different side of the planet or of Texas. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And Waco was great because it's kind of smack dab in the middle of everything. So, you know, it's an hour and a half to Dallas, hour and a half to Austin, you know, a few hours down to Houston. So the touring thing was pretty easy from that, you know, central location.
Yeah. What'd you study?
I studied English. I went in as a business major and very quickly found out that was not not going to work for me.
Good move. It's a different mindset. Well, I mean, even in college, I mean, you were doing music. You were doing the thing. I mean, was that the idea?
Right.
Like you were going to major in business and like learn a few things and still do the music thing, but you had this card in your pocket?
Yeah. I mean, what I was learning too at that time, and the way I saw the like music world moving, and these people I really respected and friends of mine too, that were, you know, great musicians, not on a label, making a great living. They ran great businesses. You know, you have these artists that are, that view themselves and treat their work, or at least a part of their work as a small business. Mm. And so there's that I'm learning. I've had to learn, and that's been really good. I've learned it more by doing it than I think I ever did in the first couple semesters I tried to take business management classes. You know,
right.
So I started there, and that was kind of the thinking. It's like I'm gonna, you know, basically study entrepreneurship to some degree. And that would help me with my music, and it was just kind of lifeless for me. So I switched over to English, and it was awesome. I loved it so much.
I mean, when you say English, was it the idea of like English literature, or was it actual?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I took a bit of everything, but a lot of poetry classes. I took a poetry writing class that I was really bad at. She gave me an A because she was nice and just knew I was trying, but my poetry was just terrible.
Why was that? Most people would say, well, you write songs. What's wrong with poetry?
I know, dude. And that's what I thought, too.
Yeah. but it's different.
It didn't go well. You know, a lot of those kind of classes. What I loved, though, was American literature. I had a couple professors that just loved it, and you could tell, and they really cared about what they were talking about every day, and they were early to class every day because they were excited to teach and, you know, getting to dig into Walt Whitman with somebody who's been studying it for 30 years. Those kind of experiences are really unique and I think helped me a lot, in how I look at art and how I want to make art, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, something I've always heard, and I try to practice it. Like, if you want to be a great songwriter, is like you read like great literature,
right?
Is that a part of like a thing in your brain? Do you feel like any kind of like parallelism to that? Because your exposure, especially in college,
yeah.
I mean, you're if you're reading like Walt Whitman stuff, it's kind of like okay. I mean, you're there. You know, you're reading the right stuff. It's not just Great Expectations like you had to read in high school or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's a bar up.
Yeah, or at least the manner in which it's cared for is up. You know, I think if I would have read Great Expectations with Dr. Fulton, who was one of my professors my junior year, it would have been a wildly different experience than sophomore year at, you know, public school in Houston. So there's that for sure. But yeah, I think anybody's output, whether it's in art, like this, like we're talking about, or whether it's in relationship or whether it's in the way we treat each other, our output is contingent upon what we're feeding ourselves, you know, like, the reason why Alex and I are so grateful for our good friends that love us so well and care for us so deeply is because we are then able to care and love for each other so deeply, you know, like it's in the water in that way. And that's the way the literature has worked for me. And now without like deadlines and a professor I have to report to, it's a lot harder to force myself to read, but when I do, it's good, you know?
Yeah. Right. Right.
So yeah, I think it's important to be fed in that way. It's good for the left brain, you know, the like mechanics of writing, I think. But I think it's also really good for me and my spirit, you know, and Walt Whitman's a great example, is thinking about the spirit that is Walt Whitman, you know, and how he looks at the world. Is a really important thing for me and has been an important thing for me to think about. You know, these kind of things are living and breathing, you know, these books that they've written, these words still mean something today. And that's significant, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting that. I'm getting a little bit of a sense who you are. It's like, where does Csorba come from? What is that?
Csorba is Hungarian. Yeah, so my grandfather, my dad's dad, he was a refugee in the 50s, in 1956.
Oh, wow.
So he, you know, Soviets came in and invaded his hometown, and the young people of Hungary were revolting. And he escaped and eventually ended up in Canada and started a family, and my dad eventually moved down to the States, so... my grandfather was awesome. I mean, he passed away probably five to 10 years ago. Can't quite remember, but, he kept his accent till the day he died. And, you know, so yeah, the Csorba side of my family is very like American dream, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom's side is, you know, an old Texas family, you know, they've always been here and, two very different backgrounds my parents came from, which I think, especially in times like these that seem really, you know, stressful and tense, I think just having those two parts of me kind of helps me look at the world maybe a bit more level-headed.
Well, I feel like it has to give you perspective a little bit. You know, you're third generation, you know, well, I guess you're second generation American. I feel like there's got to be pressure there. I mean, I don't understand that, and I can't pretend to fully understand, but I feel like there's something there. But then, yeah, your mom as well. I feel like there's a lot of pressure, like on a couple angles, and a lot of internal struggle too somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten, it's interesting from my, you know, like an uncle type guy on my mom's side, found out I switched over to English, and, you know, he kind of looks at me and says, so you don't want to make any money?
Yeah.
You
know? Right. Right.
So you get that for sure. Which is like, no, like that's just a hard thing to explain at Christmas Eve brunch, you know?
Right.
It's a hard bun to pick. But yeah, there's also the like weight of, and I think it's part of it's good. There's maybe responsibility with the word. You know, my grandfather was not not the best dad by any means. But
well, what does that mean?
I mean, my grandfather was pretty dependent on my father towards the end of his life.
Oh, financially and just
financially and like emotionally, I'd say.
Okay.
And, you know, he was, yeah. So, he was just, you know, he had his own kind of addictions and his own kind of demons, you know, but my dad really cared for his dad really well, you know, and, towards the end of his life, my grandfather became a Christian and, you know, really, I think had a turn in the way he viewed the world and the way he looked, at the world around him. But I would say that, you know, the way my dad had really stepped up, and kind of picked himself up by his own bootstraps in a very American kind of way. It's like, what does that look like for me? How do I continue that legacy as somebody who was very well nourished and cared for as a kid? You know, it's as if that story and that legacy is easier to embrace if I were totally deprived, you know, and like totally struggling because, I think about that and struggle with that a lot, but what I've come to terms with is that, what set my dad apart, I think, from, somebody else that could have been put in his situation is his work ethic and his care for others. And you know, my dad had this, I think had this dream to provide for a family one day and make sure they're going to think about whether the next meal was coming from and so on and so forth. My dream looks a little bit different, but it takes the same kind of ingredients to get there. You know, that discipline, that self responsibility for yourself and for your people. And then also, you know, the kind of care for others that he's been able to exude his whole life.
So, I hear that. I hear that.
They're different stories for sure, but they're I think rooted in so much of the same thing.
Yeah, I think so too. And I mean, I feel like that even that a little bit back to the idea of pressure, I guess, because it's the thing of too. I mean, you're such a young generation, like American. There is a lot more pressure because I mean, you're not like on weekends smashing like White Claw or whatever. I mean, you could be for all I know, but at the same time, it's like you're not like this thing that I feel like most like 20-something-year-olds are. Like you got a lot more pressure just because of like your upbringing, like the dichotomy relationship of like your grandfather and your dad, and like you're a kid too. It's like you're in the back seat of the car, just kind of watching this as they're in the front seat. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that brings perspective in a lot of ways, especially in a family dynamic. And then also, like your literature background, that's if you can't like travel the world, I mean, I feel like that has to be the thing of perspective. I mean, that's what you get from reading like really good shit and not just, again, like Animal Farm from high school or something.
Right. Yeah. And I think I've experienced that with records too. Are you much familiar with like guys like Lightnin' Hopkins
and 100%.
You know, these old kind of black blues gospel kind of players.
Yeah.
You know, my brother who introduced me to Townes Van Zandt when I was, you know, a little kid, he was kinda like, hey, if you like Townes, then you have to like Lightnin' Hopkins.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Townes is obsessed with Lightnin', and that obviously leads you down the train of Mississippi John Hurt and Big Bill Brunzy and you know, Sonny Boy Williams and all these guys. And so what I learned as a kid too is I got to see that world and experience the world through those voices and those recordings. And so I'd say that's a big part of my upbringing too. And it's kind of like maybe served as a placeholder there until I can really experience the world for myself, maybe.
Yeah. I feel like you're a little bit of an old soul, you know, I mean, because some of these songs and stuff is like, especially for this record, and I know your relationship with Bo from the Texas Gentleman, but
yeah,
I feel like there's like a classy, like kind of refinement to this record. And yeah, dude, I can totally hear like the Townes thing. I can hear like there's a lot of inspirations from like Lightnin' Hopkins and especially like the guitar playing a little bit. I mean, and we share a lot of the same heroes. So I was like able to like pick out like a lot of stuff, but I just feel like you think differently. And that's why I was even bugging you about like some of the literature and stuff, because I feel like for you to do what you do, it's either like you're fucked up in the head, like something happened, Or it's like you have a massive amount of perspective somewhere.
I've been fortunate to be given the tools, you know, I think, and by no means can I completely accept that I have a massive amount of perspective, but with what I do have, it's come from, I think, people giving me the right tools, you know, my brother being smart enough to say, hey, here's the history of why Townsend is Townsend Zan, you know?
Yeah.
And Bo being able to say in the studio, like, really nonchalantly, like, oh, if you've never heard of Willis Allen Ramsey, well, here you go.
Yeah, right.
And it, you know, obviously that's one of my favorite records ever. And so I've been really grateful to be surrounded by people that have pointed me in the direction of really rich and deep wells of inspiration, you know.
I mean, your voice lends it to that too, you know, because like your speaking voice and your singing voice, especially for you, is not the same. Like, and yeah, it's not a bad thing, I promise, but it's the thing of, oh man, I hear age in that. I feel like you may be a smoker for all I know, but it feels like you've been smoking for like 20 years, you know? It's like, it feels like your vocal cords got some wrinkles on it, you know?
Thanks, I guess. I appreciate it.
It's a compliment, I promise. It really is. But but I think it's back to somewhat of a question. It's like, I mean, do you feel like you're an old soul? I mean, do you feel like you have this massive amount of perspective and that like even personifies into even your voice and even your songs as well?
I don't know. I think I like old things.
Mm.
I also really like doing things that old people do.
Like what? What does that mean?
Like I love diner food.
Oh, I do too.
You know, like, I love diner coffee.
I
do too.
I tell people all the time I want to grow up to be like that old dude at like either like yeah, McDonald's, and we all know those old men at McDonald's, or yeah, like the old diner situation. Yeah.
Right. He's got the same bar stool. He's going to be sitting there every time.
100%. Where's the same cap? It's either blue or red
cap. Right. And he's doing the crossword.
Yeah.
That's like,
yeah,
that is like, if I could give you an image of what I hope my 60s to look like, I think that would be it.
So
I definitely have that. Like, I'm a lover of those kind of simple things. I guess that's like being a romantic in some ways. Mm. Like that, the spirit of that, I really, really love. And you know, I think the reason why Bo and I get along so well is because he's the same way. And you know, this is kind of a digression a little bit, but we've been co-writing a few songs together recently, and one of the songs on the record, Heartache, was like very like literally about a diner right down the street from our houses, because we live right here in the same neighborhood in Dallas. But
oh, nice.
But yeah, I think I like old things, and I'd like to be older maybe than I am. I think too, here's something I haven't thought about in a while. I, you know, being the youngest kid in the room for 23 years, you know,
mm-hmm,
I was the youngest child in my family. I was touring and playing shows and in the studio with like 40-year-old men who were like fantastic musicians and kind of like, okay, let's see what this kid can do. I kind of had to act like an adult a lot of the times. And maybe that has something to do with it. But yeah, I just like old things, and I like thinking that I'm older than I am. Maybe.
did you write, do you have your name on all the songs?
Yeah. There are a couple co-writes. There's a song called Walking Sideways I wrote with my buddy Wesley. He's a fantastic, fantastic writer.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that song.
He's worked on a new record. And then Bo and I both co-wrote Heartache After Heartache and What's Left of Mine.
Yeah.
And then obviously Plastic Jesus is an old folk song that
right,
I added some lyrics to.
And most people know that from Cool Hand Luke, you know? And how did you discover that song? Was it the movie or did you know it was a folk song?
It was Cool Hand Luke. It was one of my brother's favorite movies and he made me watch it. And it's always been kind of stuck in my head. I played it for Bo, like we were checking microphones in the studio and I was kind of playing it around and he was like, dude, what is that? I was like, oh, it's an old folk song. He's like, let's put that on the record. And, you know, I thought that was off limits. I've always been very, like, closed off to the idea of co-writing or using other people's songs or whatever. It felt disingenuous to me. But Bo is just open, you know, and he follows his ears really well and follows his gut. And he's like, oh, that would be a cool way to tie this record in a bow. Yeah.
That's cool. Because that song, like in the context of the movie, like it's in a, like his mom died, I think, from memory.
Yeah.
Yeah. It has this perspective of like, oh man, like his mom just died and he's sitting with a guitar or banjo. I'm trying to go off memory here.
He's got a banjo. Yeah. It's like raining.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
sitting there on his top bunk. Paul Newman, man. Gotta love him.
Dude, such an artist. Like on every level, like such an artist.
Yeah.
But the thing of like that perspective was is uniquely different than like your presentation too, you know?
Sure.
So like, but it's like, it's two different, it's same song. Obviously you changed a little bit, but it's like the perspective of it or just the, even the reception to me in my ears is like two different worlds. And I think that's like the coolest thing you could probably do like with a quote unquote cover.
Well, yeah. Isn't that like, man, to me, that just marks a good song. You know, like when I think a similar conversation is just John Prine starting out by saying, I'm an old woman, you know, an angel from Montgomery. It's like, if it's a good song, it's going to fly, you know, and you're going to be able to be Bonnie Raitt and just belt it, or you're able to gonna be able to, you know, be John Prine and, you know, frame that song in a way that is like such a vignette of something that doesn't quite exist, but totally could, but, you know, it's like out of reach. Those are two very different interpretations of that song. And the reason why that can exist is because it's a good song, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's hard to fuck up a good song in my like opinion. I mean, there's probably exceptions to that. I always compare at least this idea to movies like Peter Jackson's like The Hobbit. I fucking hate it, but you can't ruin The Hobbit because the story, the core of it is amazing. It's really good.
Yeah.
I just have my own personal feelings against Peter Jackson, but he still didn't fuck it up because it's still a great story. Like in the core of it, everything is there. And I feel like that's kind of what you're saying with Plastic Jesus too. Like whatever that the core, the heart of that song is, that thing that makes it gut-wrenching and somber, but with a twerk of like humor behind it. Like that's the core of it.
I agree. It's interesting too, because I'm thinking about like, you know, that moment in playing it for Bo. And it was the first time he heard the song was me with an acoustic guitar playing it a little faster, you know, like kind of like having a good time with the guys in the studio and smoking a little bit, you know? That was the first time he heard it in that way. If he would have heard Paul Newman sing it in the way that he does in Cool Hand Luke, I wonder if Bo would have thought about that song differently.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that's, you know, that's an interesting thing to me too. It's like, what's the, you know, this idea of like the original version of a song being king is kind of hard for me. I think it's, you know, music is so ethereal. It's so like otherworldly that I don't think that us humans can really call the shots.
Right.
You know, like,
right.
It kind of exists, and we just have to, like, put it on tape, you know?
Yeah, it's, like, this is speaking my language, because I understand that. Like, you just kind of feel like you're just grabbing shit out of the universe. But, like, to a gin pop, it's kind of like, well, you're just writing it on paper, you know?
Sure, yeah. It feels like, It feels like when you're writing a song, maybe you're solving you're solving a puzzle. You know, like there are all these things that I bring to the table that I've either read or seen or heard about. And what's excited me recently about co-writing is that not only do I get to bring all those things to the table, but somebody else is bringing just that same amount of things. We have double the pool of things to pull from. And you can make a much more expansive and beautiful thing that wouldn't have existed in that way otherwise.
Yeah. All right. A weird question, I feel like, but I think you'll get it. I think you're creative enough. Like, are you your songs or are the songs you?
Am I my songs or are the songs me?
Yeah.
Man,
and there's no A
know.
Or B. I mean, there can be an in-between, whatever that means.
Yeah, I feel like when I was 16 and 17, 18 years old, I thought the two things, the two parties in this question, the me and the song, were so synonymous, you know? I viewed songwriting so much as bleeding publicly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the more I do it and the more I think about my role in creating these songs is I find myself so much further separated from the equation. And I'm able to clock out in that way a little bit more. I'm thinking about Randy Newman. Oh, great example. Glad that one popped into my mind. His record "Good Old Boys" from 1979.
So
like,
good.
You can't. I don't think many other people could put out that record.
Right. That is a Randy Newman record. Like, yeah, 100%.
It's a Randy Newman record, and the reason why is because you know that he is not this song. You know that he has separated himself from the voice of the speaker in that song, "Rednecks." You know, like, and he's so confident in that separation between him and the speaker, that he will go balls to the wall on a song like "Redneck."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
To the point where it's uncomfortable, and so effective. And so I like to think that I lean that way. I think recently I've been thinking about songwriting that way more. I think a lot of, you know, there are songs on the record that are so much my story and so much just not, you know.
But like for you, I'm so glad we got into your background, because I mean that explains this record to me, because I mean there's so many like little gems in this thing that I really love. Like Expectation Runs is one of my favorites. Man, that is a fucking beautiful song.
Thanks, dude.
But it's about, like, to me at least, like disappointment, like, is a theme that kind of shines through. And like eventually, like toward the song, it's like there's a little bit of reality, but to me, there's always there's dark reality, and maybe that's kind of what I'm seeing a little bit. But at the end of it, it feels like you're looking for optimism.
Yeah, you know, that kind of song is almost problematic for me. You know, like I wonder whether I've rode the line there well or whether I crossed it. You know, like I'm not an only son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I have a big brother and two sisters. But that song, I think, explains a way that I've felt at times, you know, and in that way, maybe there's a separation there. It's like, this isn't me. This is like a version of me at one specific moment, you know?
Yeah, right.
And that those moments are so important, I think. And important to grab onto and say, hey, for 3 minutes and 30 seconds, we're going to look at this moment. You know, that's what I love about music and songwriting.
I think Another Man in Me is like another like example of that, right? Just a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think there's moments in that song, it's like, it doesn't feel like, you know, oh, it's Thomas Chorba, you know, like it feels, you know, like as far as the narrative or like the thing, but there is a little bit, you know, there is like something within you, call it your past or your present or whatever, that there is something like within you, no matter what that is.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I put out a record a while ago called From the Foxhole, and one of the songs on that record was called Harvest. And that song, you know, I realized in playing that song for years after I released it, like, how beautiful it is to see a song kind of serve you, serve my spirit, you know, in another life, you know, after the record's already done, quote unquote, forgotten about, as if anybody remembered it in the first place. I think Another Man in Me was kind of, I feel like that's what I was trying to do there, is like, let it serve as a reminder to me, you know, and let it live. And hopefully I'm still playing that song live, you know, 5-10 years from now, whatever. But I think that it'll be a good reminder to me that I can do better. I can be a better spouse. I can be a better friend, you know. Maybe at that point I can be a better father. Who knows, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's apparent that you love stories too, because when I listen to Some Place to Go to me is like, okay, this makes sense. Like, this guy, like, he is a writer. Like, he can really take an outer body experience, look over it, hover it, and then, like, put a narrative behind it.
Some of these songs are 2.5-3 years old, you know, and that song Heartache, for example, is as new as March, you know. Like, it's so weird how expansive this, making this record has been, and I don't even remember where I was when I wrote Some Place to Go, but it's cool. It's cool that it's still alive and it's coming out on this record. You know, like, there are a lot of those cool little things that I'm really grateful for. Grateful that I kind of captured them while I could, you know,
because
they don't feel like mine, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's there's a sense of humility behind that, that I like, but man, this is a jam. Like, this is a night record for me. This is either like a late night drive record, like when you're by yourself, or it's like, it is like a night record, like sit on the deck and like smoke a cigar kind of thing. It's nice, man.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. You and Bo Bedford, I think you guys got something there. I'm excited to see what's going to happen to you in the future, man. It's a great record.
Well, thank you. I'm grateful to have made the thing, and I hope to, you know, with Bo especially, like, I just love working with him, and it's so exciting and fun to have he really does feel like a collaborative partner, you know? And that's a fun thing to do. But thank you, man. Thanks for digging into the tunes and listening. Like, that means a lot. Thanks for, you know, actually giving it the time of day.
Bro, really, that's what you're supposed to do. Like, maybe you've done this long enough. Don't you hate those interviews? Like, because I know I've been in them. Like, they could give two shits about you. They've never listened to the music, and it's like, it's like, I mean, could you listen to it just a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it, dude. I mean, regardless of whether or not it was your job to listen to this record, like it does, it really does mean a lot. You'd engage with it. I'm so excited to, you know, for people to hear the whole thing, this fall, and hopefully get to come play these shows, these songs live for them someday. Just hearing you talk about these songs and ask about them is a huge, huge encouragement.
Yeah,
so,
man.
Thank you.
It'll happen. It'll happen one day. Not next month by any means, but one day.
Yeah.
All right, let's face it, folks. I mean, we know it's not happening anytime soon, right? This normalcy thing. But the thing that can happen soon on September 25th is that you can go check out this new self-titled record, Thomas Chorba. You won't be disappointed whatsoever. It's on all streaming platforms. Crooked Kind of Free is the newest single from the self-titled album. Go to Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Music, wherever you listen to music. But if you are one of, you know, these guys, two thumbs at this guy that likes to buy music still, you can go to his website, thomaschorba.com. Of course, go give him a follow at Thomas Chorba Music, and you can go check out all his other socials from his website. But go to the website, go buy music for George's sake. Why not? All right, folks, that's it for the episode. Really huge thanks and hugs and loves and high fives to Thomas Chorba for doing this thing. Man, hugs, that's a thing of the past. That's weird. And even high fives. Ugh. Anyway, that's it for me. You guys know what to do. If you enjoyed this episode, you got something out of it, you enjoyed the sheer entertainment aspect of it, I just ask that you just share it with a friend. We're on the American Songwriter Podcast Network, so be sure to go check out all those other shows. And we release episodes every Tuesday, and every once in a while a sneaky one during the week. But be sure to stay up to date and know when new episodes are out. Or one, give us a follow at Unofficial Brandon or at SMI Podcast, and even subscribe in your favorite podcast network platform situation. All right, folks, that's it for me. Happy surviving out there. Really be kind. Be not stupid.